oh, look, I didn't offend too many after that last session. A few came back. I want to thank everyone for coming. The majority of you did not know who I am, and that always shows a little bit of courage on your part, not knowing what you're about to get into if you come to something like this. It's different. I hope that it has been informative. I hope in some way it has been entertaining as well. If you have suggestions, like I said, this is our first try at this, my first try. If you have suggestions that you think would make it better, either, you know, tell me, or in the future get with Brad, let him know. He can get those suggestions to me, because I do want to make it as engaging as possible. You know, I don't want to make it boring. I know last session to some extent was a little deeper than the prior sessions, but you know, some sessions you can't get around that. I hope this one's not quite that bad. James Garfield is an incredible man. I had always known, as far as I can remember, I've always known that Garfield was, quote, associated with the church. Today, would I be in fellowship with James Garfield? I don't know, to be honest with you. For that matter, would I be in fellowship with Alexander Campbell? I don't know, because he was premillennialist. You know, I do believe that they were both members of the church. And I don't want to get off on a tangent, I've had some individuals who were a little bit concerned that I was including James Garfield in this. I don't necessarily have to agree with everything that these men believed in to appreciate the good that they did do. And I want to make it clear, I'm not, because I'm talking about these individuals, I'm not saying that I would be in complete full fellowship with them today if they were living. But again, you know, I think we have, in some respects, we have to turn their salvation over to God. I do know it's absolutely mandatory to follow the steps of salvation. You have to be baptized for the remission of sins to be a Christian. I know that for a fact. How much after that, how much leeway does God give for them to grow out of what they were coming out of, for him to accept them into heaven? I'm leaving that up to him. Okay? Now, there are some individuals during that time period who I will tell you, I don't think they're going to be saved. Just flat out. Garfield really kind of is right on the fence for me. Garfield, toward the end of his life, was giving funds for churches to bring in the piano for the Missionary Society, other things. And as I go through this, you'll see that he willingly chose, to some respect, to go the direction he went. So where he ended up as far as his relationship with God, only God knows. So I hope that's not confusing. I hope that doesn't come across as waffling. But I think sometimes we can be too harsh in our judgment of the people back then. And then sometimes we've got people today who are going back and trying to use some of the off teachings that they had to demonstrate that, well, it should be fine for all of us today to just believe whatever. And they didn't believe that. Okay? I'm off my little soapbox. James Garfield, his parents were disciples. He was born into a family who were Christians. His uncle, Mr. Boynton, preached for several years in the community due to a lack of a trained preacher. When he was 2 years old, his father died on their farm in Ohio on the Western Reserve. He said his older brother, from the time he can remember, taught him the lesson of self-sacrifice. His older brother, I think, was 12 when he left home to find work. And he would bring the money home from his jobs and give it to his mother for their sustenance. The first time away from home, he returned with enough money to buy James new shoes so that he could walk to school properly. He made enough money at one job that he returned and built his mother a frame house, allowing her and the younger children to move out of the log cabin that they were in. James began going to school at 3 years old by riding on the shoulders of his sister, who also held the hand of the younger sister. They lived in that log cabin for the first 10 years of his life. His mother read 4 chapters of the Bible every night to the children. On Sundays, she gave time for questions. James read every book in their house, which doesn't necessarily mean there were a lot of books, but everything that was there he would read. They said that he remembered almost everything he read or heard, and many thought that he had a photographic memory. He worked as a planer with a local carpenter at a very early age and was such a hard worker that on the very first day he planed 100 boards. You say, okay. Well, that was by hand. And made as much in that day as the men who were working there were making in a week. He worked at a potash factory when he was 12. His mother worried about him taking the job due to the bad language and rough behavior of the men. James told his mother that if he was grounded in the scripture, they would not bring him down. His mother said, "Just remember that he who thinks he stands falleth." His behavior changed many of the men at the factory. He attended Geauga Seminary, which was a free will Baptist institution, which allowed both sexes to attend. There were 100 pupils, and he was astounded with their library of 150 books. He taught school back home during the break after the 2 years in the seminary and was impressed with the preacher that was there during this time and became a Christian. He was baptized in a little stream that flows into the Chagrin River. The third year at Geauga, he attended the Disciples Congregation in Orange and took part in worship leadership. And remember, this goes back to what Brad said. You hear disciple, you hear Church of Christ, you hear Christian church. They were all the same, basically, at this time. And you might even hear Baptist, and it was the same thing. The third year, anti-slavery speech. He gave one which was outstanding and impressed everyone with his abilities. Slavery was becoming a large issue in the country. The speech was in the debate society of the school under the topic, "Ought Slavery to be Abolished in the Republic?" He found it a disgrace that people fighting to be free and then reducing others to a worse slavery than that which they fought against. It was after this speech that fellow students started kidding him about sending him to Congress. It was the third year at Geauga that he met Lucretia Rudolph, his future wife. He completed Geauga in 1850. He met a student from Western Eclectic during the third year at Geauga. He attended Western Eclectic Institute in Portage County, which later became Hiram College. He began in August of 1851. It said that he quickly demonstrated he was the most advanced student. He would ring the bell and swept floors as work to help pay his way through the school. He did other work in the evenings to support himself. That library had 2,000 volumes. He took notes on every book he read with a notation of where it could be found in the book. He did this so that he would always be able to go back and find it, evidently for his sake, because he had a photographic memory, but so that he could tell people it's on this page of that book on that shelf. The second year, he became assistant teacher in the English and Ancient Languages department. The 1853-54 catalog has him listed with teachers and students. That's like Elo Sanderson. If you're familiar with that name, L.O. Sanderson was a student at Harding and on faculty. He was exceptional, too. James worked as carpenter assistant during that year. In 1852, are you ready for this? He took Latin grammar in Caesar, Greek grammar, French grammar, German grammar, Xenophon's memorabilia, and Greek Testament, among other subjects. Poor guy. And you know, they didn't have hair blowers back then either. He had to dry his hair and do everything. In 1853, he, along with other students in a translation society, which met, you know, after hours when they weren't having to study, they translated the Book of Romans along with commentary. In his diary, he noted that for one night, that in 3 hours, they translated 9 verses. While at the school, he became indispensable to the local congregation of disciples. The local preacher, Mr. Bentley, had James fill in for him when he was gone. He was sought out to speak at secular special occasions because of his speaking abilities. While there, the Fugitive Slave Law was passed by Congress. Garfield said, "A covenant with death and an agreement with hell that will destroy the authors of it. The cry of the oppressed and downtrodden will appeal to the Almighty for retribution, like that of the blood of Abel. The lightning of divine wrath will yet shiver the old, gnarled tree of slavery to pieces, leaving neither root nor branch." He was a little bit of a prophet, wasn't he? Lucretia, his future wife, began attending Western Eclectic after he started teaching. She actually sat in some of his classes. They were engaged when he was 22 and graduated. After leaving Eclectic, he looked at going on to higher college. Garfield gives the reason for not attending Bethany in a letter to a friend. "There are 3 reasons why I have decided not to go to Bethany. First, the course of study is not so extensive or thorough as in Eastern colleges." I'm with him there. "Second, Bethany leans too heavily towards slavery." He had a misunderstanding of what Alexander Campbell's position was on slavery. "Third, I am the son of disciple parents, am one myself, and have had but little acquaintance with people of other views. And having always lived in the West, I think it will make me more liberal, both in my religious and general views and sentiments, to go into a new circle where I shall be under new influences. These considerations led me to conclude to go to some New England college. I therefore wrote to the presidents of Brown, Yale, and Williams, setting forth the amount of study I had done and asking how long it would take me to finish their course. Their answers are now before me. All tell me I can graduate in 2 years. They are all brief business notes. But President Hopkins concludes with this sentence, 'If you come here, we shall be glad to do what we can for you.' Other things being so nearly equal, this sentence, which seems to be a kind of friendly grasp of the hand, has settled the question for me. I shall start for Williams next week." During breaks from Williams, he went into New Hampshire and New York and taught penmanship classes. He opened a school 1 year in Postenkill, New York, where there was a disciples' congregation. He was asked to preach by the local preacher. That was all it took. He was asked to speak more and more while there. Everyone said he would be a talented and well-known minister. His senior year, he was elected one of the editors of the Williams Quarterly. This is a quote from that paper of his. "For every village, state, and nation, there is an aggregate of native talent which God has given and by which, together with his providence, he leads that nation on and thus leads the world. In the light of these truths, we affirm that no man can understand the history of any nation or of the world who does not recognize in it the power of God. And behold his stately goings forth as he walks among the nations. It is his hand that is moving the vast superstructure of human history, and though but one of the windows were unfurnished, like that of the Arabian palace, Yet all of the powers of the earth could never complete it without the aid of the divine architect. To employ another figure, the world's history is a divine poem, of which the history of every nation is a canto and of every man a word. Its strains have been pealing along down the centuries, and though there have been mingled the discord of roaring cannon and dying men, yet to the Christian philosopher and historian, the humble listener, there has been a divine melody running through the song which speaks of hope and halcyon days to come. The record of every orphan's sigh, of every widow's prayer, of every honest heartthrob for the right is swelling that gentle strain. And when at last the great end is attained, when the lost image of God is restored to the human soul, when the church anthem can be pealed forth without a discordant note, then will angels join in the chorus, and all the sons of God again shout for joy. He was in college when he wrote that. He graduated from Williams in 1856 and was elected to give the oration at commencement. The president of the college said of him 8 years later, "The course of General Garfield has been one which the young men of the country may well emulate. A rise so rapid in both civil and military life is perhaps without example in the country. Obtaining his education almost wholly by his own exertions, and having reached the age when he could fully appreciate the highest studies, General Garfield gave himself to study with a zest and delight wholly unknown to those who find it a routine. A religious man, a man of principle, he pursued of his own accord the ends proposed by the institution. He was prompt, frank, manly, social in his tendencies, combining active exercise with habits of study, and thus did for himself what it is the object of a college to enable every young man to do. He made himself a man. There never was a time when we more needed those who would follow his example." Another professor of his, who later became president of Williams, stated this about Garfield. "He was one whom his teachers would never suspect as guilty of a dishonest or mean act, and one whom a dishonest or mean man would not approach. College life is, in some respects, a severe test of character." You got to listen to the rest of this, and I wish every college age person associated with the church would listen to this. "False notions of honor often prevail among students, so that under sanction of college custom, things are sometimes done by young men which they would scorn to do in other places. There was a manliness and honesty about Garfield that gave him power to see and do what was for his own good and the honor of the college. His life as a student was pure and noble. His moral and religious character and marked intellectual ability gave great promise of success in the world. His course since he entered active life has seemed to move on in the same line in which he moved here. He has been distinguished for hard work, clear insight into great questions of public interest, strong convictions, and manly courage. I know of no better example among our public men of success fairly won." He returned to teach at Eclectic Institute after graduation from Williams. After 1 year, he was named chairman of the board of the instructors. After 2 more years, he was named the second principal of the school. In other words, he was the president. That was just 11 years after working as a lowly towpath at a canal to help support his family. He wrote one prospective student, "Do you not feel a spirit stirring within you that longs to know how to do and to dare, to hold converse with the great world of thought, and holds before you some high and noble object to which the vigor of your mind and the strength of your arm may be given? Do you not have longings like these, which you breathe to no one, and which you feel must be heeded, or you will pass through life unsatisfied and regretful? I am sure you have them, and they will forever cling round your heart till you obey their mandate. They are the voice of that nature which God has given you, and which, when obeyed, will bless you and your fellow men." He was immensely concerned for the manners and elements of success in life. A great quote from a talk he gave on Turning Point of Life. This is incredible. "The comb of the roof at the courthouse at Ravenna, the capital of Portage County, of which Hiram was a town, divides the drops of rain, sending those that fall on the south side to the Gulf of Mexico and those on the opposite side into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, so that a mere breath of air or the flutter of a bird's wing may determine their destiny. It is so with your lives, young friends. A passing event, perhaps of trifling importance in your view, the choice of a book or companion, a stirring thought, a right resolve, the association of an hour may prove the turning point of your lives." In 1857, he decided to study law. After 2 years, he was given a lawyer's certificate by the Cleveland Bar Association. Those examining him for the admission to the bar pronounced his knowledge phenomenal, considering he had studied for such a short time. Later, Stanley Matthews on the U.S. Supreme Court stated that Garfield was one of the very best lawyers in the entire country. In the next few years, he became the most popular lecturer in Ohio. He held a debate with William Denton, a skeptic, on the question of whether all life upon the earth was developed by processes of law or had been introduced by successive creative acts. The discussion lasted 5 days and evenings and embraced 20 speeches, each 30 minutes long. The debate drew 1,000 listeners. And if I could find a copy of that debate, it would be in my library. In 1859, Garfield allowed himself to be put on the Republican ticket for the Ohio legislature. He only accepted the invitation after asking his mother for permission. She had always wanted him to be a preacher. But she told him if he could keep his religion and be in politics, she gave her blessing. He handily defeated his opponent, began his term as a state senator in January 1860 at the age of 28. In July 1861, he was appointed lieutenant colonel in the Ohio Voluntary Infantry Regiment by the governor of Ohio. His duty was to guard part of Kentucky and keep the Confederates out. He accomplished this despite he and his men contracting dysentery and other diseases. He was promoted to brigadier general in 1862, 1 year after being put in, becoming the youngest man to hold that rank. In April of that year, he arrived at Shiloh 1 day after that famous battle. He wrote his wife, "The horrible sights I have witnessed on this field, I can never describe. No blaze of glory that flashed around the magnificent triumphs of war can ever atone for the unwritten and unutterable horrors of the scene of carnage." Garfield was guilty of disobeying a direct order from the commander of the Union troops in Ohio. He was ordered to look for a runaway slave among his troops and return the slave to his master. He refused and stated that right is right. He was never brought up on the charges, and soon the Union's rule of returning runaway slaves was changed. And it was because of his action. They didn't want to have to do anything to him. He was so well known and so well liked, and he was so good that they changed the rule. In September, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. It was during these few months that Garfield was being encouraged to run for the U.S. Congress. He allowed his name to be placed on the ballot and was elected. I want you to notice, he allowed his name to be put on the ballot. He never desired political office. He only allowed his name to be put on the ballots. He would begin that term in December 1863. During 1863, at the Battle of Chickamauga, he rode a horse through enemy territory while being fired upon to reach General Thomas' position. He did this to tell Thomas to hold his position until the troops he had been with could gather more men and return to the fighting. His horse was shot dead during the ride. Two of his attendants who rode with him were killed. A New York Tribune correspondent who was on the ground at the battle wrote, "His death was certain unless Providence had more work for him to do on this footstool. He received the highest honors given because of this heroic ride and was promoted to Major General. Garfield did not want to leave his troops in the fighting to take his position in Congress, but Lincoln convinced him, and by the way, he went to the White House and Lincoln talked to him personally. Lincoln convinced him that he could do more in Congress than he was accomplishing on the battlefield. He became the youngest sitting congressman at the age of 32. In 1864, he helped write legislation for a draft so that the Union would have enough troops. In 1864, he voted for the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, abolishing slavery. Garfield did not support Lincoln's plan of reconstruction for the South after the war. Garfield strongly supported legislation giving former slaves civil rights, including full voting rights, whether or not they could read and write. During 1866, he declared that all paper money should be backed by gold. Thank you. He also supported import tariffs and other measures to protect American industry. Garfield helped write and then influence passage creating a federal Department of Education in 1867. This is a quote of his from a speech in 1867. "Mankind have been slow to believe that order reigns in the universe, that the world is a cosmos and not a chaos. The divinities of heathen superstition still linger in one form or another in the faith of the ignorant, and even intelligent men shrink from the contemplation of one supreme will acting regularly, not fortuitously, through laws beautiful and simple rather than through a fitful and capricious system of intervention. The scientific spirit has cast out the demons and presented us with nature clothed in her right mind and living under the reign of law. It has given us, for the sorceries of the alchemist, the beautiful laws of chemistry, for the dreams of the astrologer, the sublime truths of astronomy, for the wild visions of cosmogony, the monumental records of geology, for the anarchy of diabolism, the laws of God." Garfield never desired to be in the political limelight, but when pressed by others, he allowed himself to be placed there. An insight into his mindset comes from a private letter he wrote to President Hinsdale. "You know that I have always said that my whole public life was an experiment to determine whether an intelligent people would sustain a man in acting sensibly on each proposition that arose and in doing nothing for mere show or for demagogical effect. I do not now remember that I ever cast a vote of that latter sort. Perhaps it is true that the demagogue will succeed when honorable statesmanship will fail. If so, public life is the hollowest of all shams." In March 1881, he was inaugurated as the 20th President of the United States. At a party with his old 1856 Williams College classmates, he stated, "This honor comes to me unsought. I have never had the presidential fever, not even for a day, nor have I it tonight. I have no feeling of elation in view of the position I am now called upon to fill. I would thank God were I today a freelance in the House or the Senate. But it is not to be, and I will go forward to meet the responsibilities and discharge the duties that are before me with all the firmness and ability I can command. I hope you will be able conscientiously to approve my conduct. And when I return to private life, I wish you to give me another class meeting." After he was sworn in by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he reverently kissed the Bible, returned it to the judge. He turned, kissed his mother, who had lived long enough to see her son become president. Saturday morning, July 2nd, 1881, he's in a train depot to take a train ride to Williams College for its commencement. He was to speak. He was shot twice, once in the arm and then in the back. The bullet fractured the front of his spine and lodged in the left side of his body. It was assassin Charles Jules Guiteau who shot him because He did not get a political job. Garfield had never met him, didn't know who he was. He made his appointments. Guiteau was not given an appointment, so he decided to kill the president. As time passed, pus began draining from the wound site. Doctors began inserting flexible tubes in the wound and advancing them along what they thought the path of the bullet had been. They were mistaken in that they thought it went forward and down into his abdomen. By forcing the tubes in this direction, they actually created new paths for the pus to travel into his body rather than out of his body. And personally, I cannot imagine how painful that must have been, because they were forcing those tubes through healthy tissue. That's just amazing. By forcing the tubes in the direction, they actually created new paths for the pus. This contributed to his eventual death. On August 27, 1881, the leaders of the churches in Washington consulted together and decided to make Sunday, August 28, a day of prayer for the president. Messages were sent across the country, and that day was given to prayer for the president of the United States in every church in the nation. This quote is from a paper in Boston, Monday, August 29, 1881. And oh, could our society learn something. Through the length and breadth of the land, there were few pulpits of any denomination of Christians in which no reference was made to President Garfield's condition on Sunday, and few worshiping assemblies in which earnest prayer was not offered for his recovery. There was no need of any special summons to this service. It was the spontaneous and natural expression of the national feeling. The heavy tidings of Saturday had prepared all for the worst. The physicians had abandoned hope, and all human help seemed to have been tried and to have failed. And in an agony of prayer, the whole nation, with one consent, directed its entreaties to him who holds men and nations in his hands. Never before, probably, have so many prayers been offered at one time in behalf of one man. Those who have faith in prayer must have had their confidence strengthened by the thought of such a solemn unity of petition. And those who little faith in religious things can hardly have failed to be impressed by it. To many minds, the strange end marked improvement in the president's condition reported during the day must have seemed a fresh reason for belief in the efficacy of prayer. Whether these countless prayers are answered in the way in which those who offered them desire or not, only good can come from this deepened sense of the nation's dependence upon God. An Illinois editor wrote, "The statement that President Garfield has never done better service to the nation than since he was stricken down is one that will meet an amen in every heart. The Christian fortitude, the perfect submission, the heroic desire to live if possible, but to die bravely and resignedly if he must, the chivalric devotion to and careful thought for his wife and children and mother have given the country an exhibition of high manhood and nobility of character most salutary." The effect will not be ephemeral. General Garfield, on his bed of death, as it promised to be, has elevated the American people. They will not soon forget the lessons he has taught. Well, they have now. Hopefully, through this presentation, you can go and educate others about what the American presidency under Garfield was about. Garfield died September 19, 1881 at 10:35 p.m. He had years before told General Mussey and repeated it several times over the years to the general that he believed he would die on the anniversary of his advancement to Major General. That was the advancement he received for the heroic, death-defying ride during the Battle of Chickamauga. His funeral in Washington was kept short, singing of one of his favorite hymns, "Asleep in Jesus, Blessed Sheep." reading of the scriptures, two prayers, one by Isaac Arendt and the other by J.G. Butler, and a brief address by his preacher, F.D. Powers. A portion of that address, we sit half crushed amid the ruin it has brought. A million prayers and hopes and tears, as far as human wisdom sees, were vain. Our loved one has passed from us, but there is relief. We look away from the body, we forget for a time the things that are seen. We remember with joy his faith in the Son of God, whose gospel he sometimes himself preached and which he always truly loved. We see light and blue sky through the cloud structure, and beauty instead of ruin. Glory, honor, immortality, spiritual and eternal life in the place of decay and death. The chief glory of this man, as we think of him now, was his discipleship in the school of Christ. His attainments as scholar and statesman will be the theme of our orators and historians, and they must be worthy men to speak his praise worthily. But it is as a Christian that we love to think of him now. It was this which made his life to man an invaluable boon, his death to us an unspeakable loss, his eternity to himself an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, and that fadeth not away. Psalm number 674, if you would turn there.